Okay, we'll get started again. So, again, one of the takeaway points from the previous lecture is that effects of the channel are not uniform across the entire frequency. And so if you have narrowband systems, you can sometimes have sort of greater impact than you would expect on the quality of the signal. And so, in order to combat this, one option is to spread the spectrum of your signal, so transmit it along a wider frequency range, and then, again, those effects are still there, but they're only there for a portion of the region along which you're transmitting your signal. So, one way of doing this is what's called spread spectrum modulation. And we'll see sort of how the techniques actually work. But again, the idea is to take a narrowband signal and spread it over the spectrum. The trick to all of this is that at the same time, we still want to get an efficient use of our spectrum. So if we're going to sort of have our signal in a wider bandwidth, then we're going to have to somehow compensate. And what we'll see is that the sort of cleverness of these techniques is in allowing multiple signals to operate in the same bandwidth. Okay. The reference for this material is Chapter 7 of William Stallings, and again, it's quite readable, so you should have a look at it. Okay, so again, the basic idea is that our channel encoder has produced a narrow bandwidth signal, and we're going to use our modulator to spread the bandwidth of that signal. And the advantages are we're going to gain some immunity to noise and these multipath fading effects. And again, it's not exactly an advantage, but it's a necessity more. We'll do this in a clever way so that we can share the spectrum among a number of users at the same time. Okay, so again, this broader bandwidth, this broader spectrum is not just going to be the sole domain of one signal, but now we'll have multiple signals in the same bandwidth. Okay. And so, again, we use what are called spreading codes to achieve this, and we'll see how they work for both frequency shift keying and also sort of direct encoding of bits. Okay, so the first technique we're going to look at is what's called frequency hopping spread spectrum. And here we're going to divide our spectrum into some number of subchannels, and this gives us the number of hops possible. Okay. And the transmitter is going to operate on one subchannel for a fixed period of time, and then it's going to shift the signal to another subchannel. Okay. And so again, you're moving across now a larger spectrum, although again you're only in some small portion of it at any given time. The choice of the subchannel, the carrier frequency at which you're going to transmit at any given time, is a function of the spreading code. Okay. And so we're going to take our initial signal and we're going to choose a frequency carrier to sort of modulate that signal by, and so again that's going to move it around the frequency spectrum, and then we'll filter the filter acts to sort of get the main component of our system and not our subcomponents. We'll see that in a minute. Transmit that on, and then if we reapply the same code at the other side and filter, we'll recover our signal. Okay. So at the sending side, we have our initial signal, okay, with a base frequency, and then our frequency, this is the BI, gives us our frequency shift keying. But we combine that signal with now our spread spectrum signal, okay, which, and the purpose of this is going to be to shift the frequency of the signal. So we'll get two or more frequency shifts here, or well, in this case, this is just frequency shift keying, so we get two frequency shifts here, and then we get additional frequencies over a wider range by applying our spread spectrum signal, also called a chipping signal. And so this is the combination of two cosines, and what we see is that when we multiply them together, we get a signal at the sum of the frequencies and the difference of the frequencies, and the portion that we want to recover is the portion at the sum of the frequencies, so we filter that portion of the signal, and that's what's transmitted. At the receiver, again, we apply the same code, and here what we want to do is recover the difference of the two frequencies, so essentially we're going to subtract back off our chipping frequency, and again, if we filter that, we can recover our initial signal, although, again, at lower amplitude. Okay. And so that's an example for how that works for frequency shift keying. So you just have two frequencies. Obviously, it doesn't matter if your initial modulation scheme has more than two frequencies. The same shifting up and down will occur when you apply the spread spectrum code or chipping frequency. Now, So, again, we can think of sort of our original signal might have sort of, again, transmitted at a number of different frequencies, a number of frequency levels. The code is going to move that initial translation to a different portion of the frequency spectrum. Okay. Now, according to the initial encode modulation scheme, whether it's sort of using multiple levels or not, the signaling element is always going to change at a duration TS. So that's the period of the signaling element. And what bit rate exactly you get out of that depends on the number of levels and how many bits you've encoded into that signaling element. Okay, so that changes at a certain rate. And then our hopping occurs at a certain rate as well. That will occur periodically at every TC seconds. Okay, and so the hopping is again taking this spectrum and moving it to some other portion of the spectrum. Okay. And frequency hop spread spectrum systems are characterized according to how frequently that hopping occurs. Okay. And so if you can fit a number of signaling elements into a hop period, it's what's called slow frequency hop spread spectrum. If you hop a number of times while transmitting the same signaling element, then it's called fast frequency hop spread spectrum. Okay. And so to give an example, here we are using a two-level frequency shift keying, so we're able to represent four-level, we're able to represent 2 bits per signaling element. And then our code, so our spread spectrum hop is occurring every 4 bits or every 2 signaling elements. Okay. And again, what we can see happens here is that we have our initial frequency spectrum would have been here, and we've spread that out. Since again, we're using a 2-bit code, we have 4 possibilities. So we now have 4 times the frequency spectrum being used. Okay. And what happens with every frequency hop is the signal that we've originally been here is just hopped to some other option of the frequency range. Okay. So, again, to start, we have our code is 00, so that represents this portion of the spectrum, and we transmit 4 bits or 2 signaling elements while we're
before we hop. So 0, 0 gets us here, and 1, 1 gets us here. Then we hop. Okay, and we're now in one, the code is 1, 0, so that gets us up to our third region. And within that region, you know, 1, 0 is here and 1, 1 is here. And again, after 2 signaling elements or 4 bits, we hop again. And we're in our top region now, and 0, 1 is here and 1, 0 is here. And so just keep going in that fashion. Okay. If you have fast frequency hopping now, you're going to make multiple hops per signaling element. And so again, for our example of fast frequency hop spread spectrum, we are going to be transmitting 2 bits per signal. Okay, so four signaling elements all together. And what we see now is that our hop frequency changes over the duration of one signaling element. Okay. So here, if we think of our signaling element 0, 0, typically, without hopping, this would be down at this lowest frequency here. But now, in halfway through transmission of the signaling element, we hop. And again, where we hop is determined by our code. And so in this case, we hop from our first PN value is 0, 0, down here, and then we hop to the second value here. Okay. Then we would move on. So that's one signaling element. We'd move on to transmitting our second signaling element, which is 1, 1. And again, we hop twice during the transmission of this element. Our first hop takes us to 1, 1. So it's to our top range, and then our second hop takes us to 1, 0, or our second highest range here. And so you go on doing that.
Okay. So the value in doing this is in sort of avoiding sort of or lessening the impact of losses in sort of any narrow frequency range. And so there are 2 ways of looking at this. Again, for our purposes, we might think that a certain frequency is getting wiped out. And if that's true, then a portion of your signal is getting wiped out, but not the whole signal. So potentially you can compensate. The other option for the way of looking at it is in terms of jamming and sort of a more adversarial situation. And this is where these would have originally arisen. And the idea is for a narrowband signal, well, the jamming can concentrate its power over, the jammer can concentrate power over the sort of narrow bandwidth. But now the bandwidth, the jamming bandwidth would have to be spread over, again, this larger spectrum. So you either need to use a lot more power, or for the same power, you're not going to get the same effect. Okay. And so, again, that's all we're saying here is that if you have a fixed power jammer, but you've now spread, if you have to spread the power over this greater spectrum, then your power in any portion of that spectrum is correspondingly reduced. Okay, so a second option for spread spectrum is what's called direct sequence spread spectrum, and this is used with phase shift keying. And so the idea here is to essentially increase the number of bits representing your signal, and again, because these are being transmitted sort of over shorter time periods, the spectrum is correspondingly increased. So in this case, what we have is for any channel, we have a code which we apply to our bits, which turns our single bit representation into a multiple bit representation, and again, which is increasing the bit rate at which the signal is transmitted. Okay. So here our code is, again, a sequence of bits, and it's applied to our initial signal. And so when they're combined, this will give you a combined signal to transmit. And then at the receiving end, you apply the sequence again to the signal, and this will allow you to recover your initial signal. Okay. And so this can be done by, again, either making the translation and then modulating the signal, or modulating the signal and then applying, or combining the two modulated signals. Okay. And so, again, if we look at it, a sort of mathematical representation, our initial signal is just, again, plus or minus a sinusoidal signal. And then our C of T, again, is plus or minus the sinusoidal signal. If you multiply the two of them together, again, you'll get this C of T is not, C of T is just plus or minus, a sequence of plus or minus ones. And when you multiply those together, again, you'll get a sequence of bits, which are, again, zeros, a sequence of plus or minus this sinusoidal signal. Okay. Now, again, when you reapply the C of T at the other end, well, again, you're either multiplying 1 times 1 gives you 1, or, and you can extract your original signal, or you're multiplying minus 1 times minus 1 gives you 1, you can extract your original signal. Okay. And so, again, so we have our initial bit sequence, and when we modulate that into a sinusoidal representation, we apply the spreading code, and so that's just, again, potentially flipping the representation or flipping the sign for each component. And then, again, to recover it at the other end, we would reapply this signal. And, again, we can look at this either in terms of this is more genuinely spreading the signal along the entire spectrum, and in particular, the spread is proportional or inversely proportional to the bit duration. So the shorter your bit, the wider your spectrum, and again, the impact of a factor in any sort of narrow frequency range is therefore diluted by however much you've sort of reduced your bit period or increased your bit rate. Okay. And so we can see the sort of, again, the benefit of using a system like this for sort of an individual signal. We've made it more likely that, you know, again, if you have these effects in narrow portions of the spectrum, we've made a signal that's more resistant to these sorts of effects. The problem with that, obviously, is that you're now using a wider portion of the spectrum. The spectrum is something that's in short supply. So in order to do this efficiently, what we have to do is come up with some way to share this spectrum among multiple users. So with the narrow bandwidth channels, you're assuming that only one user is transmitting on that channel at a given time. And while that still has to be true, what we can do is sort of a time multiplexing of the system so that at any given time, one user is transmitting, but sort of over a longer period, multiple users can use those same frequencies. Okay. And so the idea is that what we have to do is be clever about our coding. Okay. So as long as we can keep the users away from each other, in terms of transmitting exactly the same thing at the same time, then multiple users can coexist at the same time. Okay. And for frequency hopping, well, you can see what would have to happen is that you could have more users. They just, you know, would have to be in different, they'd have to be in different hop ranges while they were transmitting together. For for direct sequence spread spectrum, again, we're going to have to encode our signals so that we can recover our initial signal at the end. Okay. And so the idea is as follows.
we're going to have a number of users which are all transmitting at some data rate D.
And we'll think of their signals as being plus and minus 1, the bits represented by plus and minus 1. Now, each user will then have a chip code, which will break that bit into K subbits, so you're now transmitting at your rate KD. Okay. And we'll think of those, just for sort of, again, representational purposes, we'll think of the chip code as being some vector S. So that's going to be a set of K plus or minus ones. Okay. So, again, forgetting about other users, if you want to recover your initial signal, you can think of our sort of the bit is going to be represented by plus or minus S, where SI is our code. And if we take the inner product of our initial code with that, what we're going to get out is either plus or minus K. So depending on whether a 1 or a 0 was sent, you'll either have plus K for a 1, minus K for a 0. Okay. Now, if we can pick two different codes, excuse me, so that the inner product of those two codes is 0, then when we apply the code to a combined signal, we should extract out our initial signal. Okay. And so just to give an example, we have three users here with three different codes, and CA is orthogonal to CB and CC. That means that when we apply these inner products, CA inner producted with CB gives you 0, CA inner producted with CC gives you 0, and what we'll C is that, and then CB and CC are not orthogonal. So if you take the inner product, you get 1, 2, 3, minus 1 is 2, plus 1 is 3, minus 1 is 2. So they're not orthogonal to each other, but they're probably close enough that we can still recover our original signals. Okay. So, just to see how this works, again, let's start just assuming we have one signal. A wants to transmit a 1. Or a minus 1, so it starts us into the code, or the negative of the code. And when you inner product that with the initial code, if you sent a 1, well, these are all going to, this is essentially, it's the same signal twice, so you just get to take the square of each of these entries, and you'll get 6. If you sent a 0, then they're the negative of each other, so when you multiply them, you get all negatives, and you get minus 6. Okay. So, if you get some value other than 6 or minus 6, then there's been some problem with the transmission. You didn't receive all of the little subbits correctly, or someone else is transmitting with a non-orthogonal code and interfering with your signal. But
it still gives you, even in that case, it gives you some basis for trying to make a decision.
You can, you know, the easiest decision would be, well, if it's greater than zero, the original signal is a one. If it's less than zero, it's zero was transmitted.
Okay. It's not quite that easy because of the, you know, potential possibility of other signals, and maybe you weren't transmitting at all. So you might have three regions. You might have, if it's greater than three, a one was sent. If it's less than minus three, a zero was sent. And if it's in the middle there, you weren't transmitting. But you have some basis for decisions and some basis for recovery of the signal. Okay. Now, if you have orthogonal chip codes, then the senders can both transmit at the same time, and then when each individual receiver applies its code, that should be applied, the CA will be applied here too, but that should have a brackets around it. When you take the product of CA and CB, that becomes zero, so the signal from the other transmitter is, or the other sender, is factored out, and you recover your signal.
Okay. Now, again, if you have non-orthogonal chip codes, then when you reapply your chipping code to try and recover your signal, you're still going to get a contribution from the other sender's signal. And so the hope is that if the contribution is small enough, you'll still have a basis for making the correct decision. Okay. And so, for instance, in this case, C was sending a zero, so that's adding a factor of minus two to what we received. But it's still more positive than not, so if the codes are nearly orthogonal, then you can still decide which signal was, or you can still recover your original signal. Okay. So, obviously, picking your code correctly is quite important. And so, in general, the factors you look for in a spreading code is that, sort of regardless of whether we're doing CDMA or not, you want the code to be noise-like, which means the mean is approximately zero. So again, you're going to achieve uniform spreading. And you would not necessarily want repeating patterns. Again, this is more of an issue if you're worried about jamming, etc. Okay. If you're going to use the code for multiplexing for sharing your medium, then you also need orthogonality, or as close to orthogonality as possible. So the codes should be allow you to recover independent signals. Okay. So for frequency hopping, spread spectrum, and non-CDMA, direct sequence spread spectrum, PN sequences are used, and so PN just refers to a way of generating our codes. And for direct sequence CDMA systems, PN sequences can be used, and orthogonal codes, so codes that are directly designed to be orthogonal, are used. Okay. So PN sequences are produced by PN generators, which eventually repeat but appear to be random. Okay. And they, the properties that you look for a good generator is that it produces a uniform distribution, so your ones and zeros are balanced. And this happens in runs. So again, if you took 509, this is exactly what we were looking for random number generation as well. Okay. And you want independence, so you can't infer values by knowing other values. And you want them to be uncorrelated in the sense that if you shift them, then you should not start seeing correlation between shifted versions. Okay. These sorts of sequences are typically generated using linear feedback shift registers. And so what this does is it generates a sequence of n bits at a time, and it does that by some defining the nth value then as some function of our current values, and then shifting all of the values through the system. Okay, so you have a sequence of values, and you create the next value, and you shift the you shift those values down through the registers. Okay, and so properties of these sequences generated in this way are that they're periodic with a maximum period of 2 to the n. And you can always find some configuration that will give you this maximum period. All zeros will occur only if the initial state is all zeros or the coefficients are all zeros. So unless you're really stupid, you aren't going to get zero everything out. And so, again, what we're looking for is the maximal length sequences. To look at an example here, so we have to start out with an initial condition. We start out with B3 for B0, being 1, 0, 0, 0. Our feedback is B0 exclusive ORed with B1, so in the first case that gives us 0. And again, to get the next sequence, we use our shift registers, so we input B0 plus B1 into B3 and shift everybody down. Okay, so our 0 goes into B3, and all of the other values are shifted one register over. And again, then we calculate B1 exclusive ORed with B0 and shift that around and push all the registers forward. Now, our exclusive OR is 1 plus 1 exclusive ORed with 0 is 1. So we move that value in, shift everybody else down. And so again, you keep doing that. And you will see, sort of for this example anyway, that our original n was 4 bits, meaning we could get a period of 16, and that's what we get. Okay. So, again, if we choose our sequences appropriately, we get all of these nice properties. And so, in terms of correlation between the sequence and the shift of the sequence, unless you've shifted by the entire period, where obviously you get the sequence again, then there's a very low correlation. Okay, so that's a good property to have, again, because if there's any delay in the system, then you're not going to cause interference. Okay. So, in general, these are not good enough for CDMA systems, so they don't give you sort of a sufficient spread of codes. And so, sort of more complicated techniques are in general employed if you want to have this in a multiple access system. One of the most straightforward is gold sequences, where you exclusive OR two M sequences together, and sort of more complicated ones are proposed as well. And the whole goal is to get sort of adequate immunity to correlation between sequences. Okay, so to finish off for today, we'll just look at a straightforward way of directly generating orthogonal codes. And again, this is good so that for CDMA systems. And probably the most common version is the Walsh code. And Walsh codes are generated recursively. You start with a one-by-one matrix, and then you can get a matrix of twice the size, so 2x2, inserting into this formula where you insert the matrix three times and the inverse of the matrix once, and in this case, all of the rows have a cross correlation of zero, but the codes in the shifted versions, the cross correlation is non-zero, so you have to make sure that your system is synchronized. Okay. And so just to work out the example, okay, so you go from W1 to 0, so then putting in W2, these three are 0, this is a 1. W4, again, you have W2, and then the inverse of W2, and so on. And so take a minute, and again, so take W8 maybe, and assure yourself that the rows are orthogonal to each other, and then have a look at the shift of the rows and see. You can see that they're not orthogonal to each other. Okay. Now, one final trick that you can... apply to CDMA systems is normalizing the rate at which data is being transmitted. So if your initial source systems are running at two different data rates, you can even this out through the use of the code. So, again, if we think of one signal running at a certain bit rate and a second signal running at sort of twice the bit rate, then you can even that out through the use of your chipping codes. For instance, here you would divide your signal into four, so each bit would perhaps potentially be divided into four sub-bits. Here, well, each bit need only be chipped at half the rate, so you divide this bit into two sub-bits. And so by doing that, your end transmission is all running at the same rate. Okay. And so, just returning to Walsh codes, the nice thing is that it is easy to generate those different rate codes using the Walsh matrix. Okay, so that's it for today. I posted a problem for the day, which is just a sort of a fairly straightforward spread spectrum problem, but we'll go through it at the beginning of lecture next time, just to make sure everybody sees it. Have a look at it before we get to lecture, just, you know, again, see if you're clear on that or not. Next lecture, we're going to look at the design of cellular systems. And again, the main result we're going to use from this lecture is just that the signal strength decreases as some factor of the distance, and we'll see how that plays into the design of cellular systems. So that's it for today. I will see you guys next week.